This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us as we continue. It is hour number three. We're going to get into the SEC Championship Game Part 2. Monday night from the National Championship, Georgia and Alabama. You know, we thought you'd get this once, and now you get it a second time. These two teams played a game in Atlanta that didn't go the way a lot of us thought. I thought Alabama would show up, and I thought it could make it interesting, but I didn't think they'd blow out the Georgia team, and they did, winning 41-24. This is now the second time around for Georgia to go up against the big bully in the conference, and that has been Alabama, the team everybody has to play against in their head. Do we have a team that could beat Alabama should we run into them at any point along the way? SEC title, regular season, national championship. If Nick Saban's got his team rolling, do we have the team that can match it? And it's interesting because Georgia is a team that puts all the money it can into its football program. They've got the best facilities. They've got a fan base that's crazy about them. They've got sold-out crowds. They play in a great location in terms of recruiting. But look at what has been around them in the last 40 years since they won a national title. They've seen Alabama win it so many times, too many to count. They've seen Auburn win it. They saw Florida win it twice. They've seen Clemson win it. They have seen Georgia Tech win it when they were in a tie back in the 90s. They have seen teams around them win national championships. They saw Tennessee win one. And in 40 years, they have not gotten to that promised land, despite the fact they're one of the premier programs in college football. Meaning that you are a recruit and you go to Georgia, you should be impressed because they put a lot of money into making you a very comfortable football player when you're in Athens. And yet they are missing the hardware. This is the team that was supposed to end it, and they didn't look that part in the SEC title game. They did look the part against Michigan. So which team will show up? We'll talk to Mike Stratton about that next Dr. Mike SEC podcast. We'll get his thoughts on Alabama, Georgia, how this game is going to be shaking out, the SEC in general, when we keep back on Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio.
Listening to Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, national championship game coming on Monday in Indiana. It is Alabama, Georgia. It is part two, another SEC championship rematch. But this time for all the marbles, let's go to the Progressive guest line. Progressive making it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Michael Bratton joins us from SEC Mike podcast on SEC football and all of the things in the conference. How are you, Michael?
Hey, doing great. Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. Most of America is seeing this as a rematch, but these are two teams that when you play each other twice, there's different things that can happen. Do you think different things will happen in this one?
Well, I think they absolutely can, because if you just look at the totality of the season, I mean, I don't think it's even a question that Georgia has been the far, far more dominant team this season. I mean, heck, Alabama could be sitting here with three or four losses on their season. They have not really played up to their elite standard for much of the, and I'm talking specifically the second half of the season. So that just kind of adds to how bizarre it was that they went into Atlanta and basically whooped the dogs in the SEC championship game. I do not think we're going to get a repeat of that here in Indianapolis Monday night.
Yeah, if you're looking at teams and you say, okay, you play that game once, and then you look at the film and you say, okay, look, these are the things we did wrong, and these are what we can correct. Who has a better opportunity to correct what went wrong? Even Alabama, even in a win, there were things that probably Nick Saban didn't like. Who is better suited to do that, Georgia or the Tide?
Oh, I think it's absolutely Georgia. And, you know, as much as we pretend that, these guys don't hear what is being said in the media on shows like yours and by podcasts like mine. I mean, everybody knew Alabama could not afford a loss in that SEC championship. Everybody on that Georgia roster knew they essentially had a mulligan. They could lose that game and still make the playoff. You got to think that factored in a little bit. But specifically in the game, I mean, Georgia had two turnovers. Alabama had none. Georgia was 3 of 12 on third down. Alabama was 7 of 14. And Georgia had hiccups in the red zone. So they had a 10-0 lead. It's not like they just completely got blown out. Just blown coverages really killed them with Jamison Williams. And, you know, Alabama's down now. Their number two receiver, John Menchie, their starting quarter, Josh Jobe, he's out, done for the season. So Alabama suffered some significant losses since that first game. So, yeah, I go back to it. I mean, if these two teams play both up to their standard, Georgia, I think, wins easily.
In terms of the SEC lore, right, because we all know how great this conference is, and we know how important football is within these programs within the SEC. This is something we were just kind of discussing. If you're Georgia, players come and go, coaches come and go, but for a fan base that has been with this school, rooting for the school for 40 years, 30 years, what does it mean to win a national title when they've looked and seen Florida, Alabama, Auburn, Tennessee, LSU, Georgia Tech within their state, Clemson up the road, all win national titles around them in the last 40 years?
I mean, and not only that, but it usually seems when Georgia has all these massive expectations, they always fall short. So,
sure.
I mean, that just adds to the agony you just stated right there. And it's like you said, I mean, you're looking across rival after rival after rival. They've all won national championships. Man, if you just utter the word 1980, any Georgia fan, oh my, I mean, they just get into the fetal position. And I think that's going to be even worse here Monday night because it goes back to what I said. I mean, this Georgia team, if you just, you know, an unbiased view, much better than this Alabama team. And Alabama's got the vast majority of people coming back next year, whereas Georgia, their defense is particularly led by a lot of upperclassmen that are moving on to the NFL. If Kirby Smart and Georgia cannot beat this Alabama team 0-2, they go 0-2 against this Alabama team, I do not know what the pitch is if you're Kirby Smart and Georgia other than, hey, we're just going to wait Nick Saban out because he can't coach forever.
Stetson Bennett had a great game against Michigan. He did not have a very good game against Alabama, but this is a season where he has not been having to, he did not have to perform to get Georgia into games. The defense did such a magnificent job of just keeping games in check. How was that month for Stetson Bennett to hear? Because like you said, I agree with you. I think these kids hear it. I think these guys hear it. For him to hear what his performance was against Alabama to then come back and beat Michigan like he did about a month later.
Yeah, I mean, it was very impressive because that was the big thing. You know, are they going to finally insert JT Daniels? It seemed like the perfect opportunity. You got a month to prepare for Michigan. That's a month of extra practices to get JT Daniels up to speed, who, of course, was the starting quarterback when they entered the year before he got injured. Yet Stetson comes out here, and he looks like a hero. He plays maybe his best game of the season. So, you know, I think you got to give a lot of credit to Todd Monken, the offensive coordinator. I think he's done a fabulous job considering the injuries Georgia's had at receiver, the fact that they've had to juggle these quarterbacks back and forth, and that he's relying on running backs out of the backfield to be pass catchers. He's got one of the best freshman tight end I've ever seen in my life in Brock Bowers. So, yeah, he's going to need to get the most out of Stetson Bennett once again. But against last season when these two teams played in Tuscaloosa, Georgia had the lead at halftime. They had a 10-0 lead in Atlanta just a couple weeks ago. They got to finish. That's what it's all about. Four quarters of football, not a half of football. And if they do that, they're going to win Monday night.
You brought up John Metchie in terms of his loss. How will that affect him against this Georgia defense? We didn't see it much against Cincinnati. Wasn't a big factor in that game, obviously, but it could be here the second time around. How will it be for Alabama to not have him available?
Yeah, it's huge because even in that game against Cincinnati, we saw that now maybe that was the scheme because I think it was safe to say Alabama going into that Cincinnati game knew they could dominate the line of scrimmage. They opened the football game with 10 consecutive runs. Never seen anything like it in such a big game. And, you know, maybe they didn't need Jameson Williams to stretch the field, but they're going to need that against Georgia. And they're able to do that because John Metchie was more of the check down receiver. That was the role Jameson Williams played against Cincinnati. So can you beat Georgia with, you know, checking it down and such and not having that elite go receiver in the national championship? I don't think so. So who steps up? It's going to have to be one of these true freshmen. But, man, John Metchie has been making plays for three seasons for Alabama. And down him, that's a huge, huge loss. That's your number two best receiver there for Bryce Young.
When we looked at Georgia's schedule this season, they kind of rolled through it. I mean, they really didn't get much of a challenge from anybody except maybe Clemson at the beginning of the season. But Alabama did struggle. Alabama lost to Texas A&M, but Florida had them against the ropes. LSU gave them a little bit of a fit. Tennessee gave them a little bit of a fit. Ole Miss. What has been the consistent thing? If you were to point to one or two things that is the reason why some of these teams were able to just be an annoyance to Alabama, even in a loss to the Crimson Tide, what would it be?
The offensive line, which was kind of why that game in Atlanta was so baffling. Because you go back and you look at teams like LSU's had a horrible season and fired their coach. Auburn, who they started out hot, but they're basically the coolest team in the SEC. Those teams dominated Alabama on the line of scrimmage, particularly that offensive line. So you assumed Georgia and their defense, which many, myself included, was saying, hey, maybe this might be the best defense we've ever seen at the collegiate level. They've got to control Alabama in the SEC championship game. They didn't do it. So to me, it all comes down to the offensive line. As great as Bryce Young is, no quarterback is going to get it done if he's gotten pressure in his face, constantly getting harassed. And Georgia has just got to find a way to scheme up plays to do that in this championship game. They certainly didn't do it in the SEC championship game, and that's why Bryce Young picked them apart.
Brian Robinson, is he going to be able to run against the Georgia defense, or do you think that'll be a factor at all in this game?
No, I really don't, because they basically abandoned the run the first time, and I don't blame them for it, because Georgia's just so, so dominant, and it's not like they got four good linemen. It's not like they got eight good linemen. They basically got 12 linemen that they just shuffle in. So the only way to attack them is through the air, and so it just comes back to those protection issues, getting the ball out early. Bill O'Brien, he a masterful job. And I think that's something that's not getting talked enough about. Bill O'Brien, Todd Monken, they come from the NFL. They're used to scheming for an opponent twice here in a season and maybe even twice in a month like they are doing with the national championship game. So I would maybe give a slight edge to these offenses in this game because of those coaches' experience just having to play an opponent twice.
I've said this a lot, but I'll tell you for the first time. I think one of the things that I've been saying all season is when you look at Alabama, they're just one of those teams because of their success that when we look at the landscape of college football at the beginning of the season and we want to compare teams, we don't really compare Alabama. We just compare Alabama to other Alabama teams. That being said, this Crimson Tide team, if they were to win it all, with all of the things that people have been questioning and worried about, how good of a job has Nick Saban and Bill O'Brien and everybody else done with this particular team if indeed they do take it all?
Yeah, I mean, nothing at this point surprises me when you're talking about Nick Saban and his coaching ability in Alabama. So this would rate right up there because I didn't think this team had what it took to get it done. And at times I looked right and other times they maybe looked like a fool. But hey, I'm going to be picking against them one last time because I think Georgia gets it done. I think the 1980 jokes come to an end, and I think the team that I view as the better overall team gets it done Monday night. I think Alabama goes down.
It is funny because championships can come in all shapes and sizes. You know, we see teams, you know, that aren't expected to win titles, and then we see loaded teams not win titles. But if I'm a Georgia fan and I don't win the championship, I'm going to have to think, if I can't win it with this group, when am I going to ever see it?
Yeah, well, last time I checked, there's a potential Heisman contender there from Oklahoma that just jumped in the portal, and I was joking with Paul Feinbaum yesterday. Man, we're seeing all these multi-million-dollar figures getting thrown around. I would imagine if Georgia loses Monday night, Caleb Williams, his price tag is going to go up because of those folks at Athens. And maybe they get it done to go all in next season because that's what they're going to have to do. They're going to have to
without question
some mercenary to play quarterback to contend with Bryce Young.
Absolutely. Mike, appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time and your insight. Enjoy the game on Monday. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You got it. Michael Bratton, SEC Mike, the SEC podcast, joining us to give us his thoughts on these two teams playing for the national championship Monday in Indianapolis. On a Progressive guest line, quote, buy and save on home insurance with Progressive's new Home Quote Explorer, only at progressive.com. Coming up next, a mistake, maybe. Intentional, not. I'll give you the story, what happened in the one particular basketball game next on Wake Up Call.
This is Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us as we continue. It is Wake Up Call. Jason Cole's going to join us in about 13 minutes. We'll talk to him about some NFL issues as we go into Week 18. So, Ron, I don't know. I mean, you're in Houston. I don't know how much of the play this story got. But the other night, Kevin Porter hit a three-pointer against Washington.
Heard about
to
it.
To win that game, and it ended an eight-game losing skid. But the story is Washington Wizards announcer Glenn Conser. Because in his call of the game, he's an analyst in Washington. After Porter hit the three-pointer with 0.4 seconds remaining, he said this: "You gotta give it. You gotta give credit. Kevin Porter Jr., like his dad, pulled that trigger right at the right time." Now, he thought that Kevin Porter Jr. was the son of former Washington player Kevin Porter, but in reality, Kevin Porter Jr.'s father pleaded guilty to manslaughter in the shooting death of a teenager back in 1993. Conser said he made an honest mistake and deeply apologized to the Rockets, the Porter family, Kevin Porter individually. He really went all out to say, "Oh my God, I had no idea. I said this because I actually thought he was this player's son that played for Washington that I knew was a good shooter, and I wanted to make a comparison to the dad I thought he had." Now, the NBC Sports Washington said Glenn Conser apologized for a comment he made about Kevin Porter Jr. during last night's coverage of the Wizards-Rockets game. He conflated Porter's father with a former Washington player. "We join in Glenn's apology to Kevin Porter Jr. and the family." And they did say he's not being fired or suspended for this. LeBron James, though, he did not like this at all. He put out on Twitter how angry he was at this. "Oh, no, no, you're not going to be doing this. You may think it's funny. It isn't." And even after the apology, James doubled down on it and said this on social media. Or actually, he told reporters this, I should say. He put out a tweet saying that the call was unacceptable. He said, quote, "We're in a profession where it's your job to do your due diligence. We got enough people out here that's giving false narratives and false statements. We got enough of that. But in our game, in our integrity, in the NBA, the 30 teams, the beat writers, the players, coaches, the play-by-play guy, it's our job to make sure we do the best to our ability to speak the facts." Okay. I'm gonna say this. I think that this is an honest mistake. I don't know the guy. I've never worked with the guy. But I can see this being an honest mistake. Should Glenn Conser know specifically that Kevin Porter Jr. was the son of former Washington player Kevin Porter before he said that? Yes. If you're an analyst, you are kind of talking off the top of your head, okay? You can prepare for the game, but you're kind of, you know, I've been a play-by-play announcer for a number of years, and a play-by-play announcer deals with the who, what, where, when, and why of a game, right? So you call what you see, right? An analyst calls what he is thinking, what's kind of through his head, how he sees something that didn't look right, that play doesn't make sense, that play is the right play. Every kind of possibility is going through an analyst's head.
Yeah, he analyzes the game.
He analyzes what he is seeing. It's a little bit, and I'm not meaning this to disparage good analysts, because I know good analysts work hard. But let me just say this, and this is not at the upper level. I've done this at the college level. I've showed up at a game an hour before a tip-off. I've got 100 notes. I've had color commentators show up 5 minutes before the tip-off with zero notes. Because, again, what are we asking him to do? See, comment, just tell me what you see. I'm the one that's got to get all the players' information right. I'm the one that has to get the pronunciations right. I'm the one that is going to tell you where they're from. I'm the one that's going to tell you that they're averaging 22 points per game. I'm the one that's going to tell you he started the last three games after taking over for this player who got hurt in the fourth game of the season. That's what I'm going to do as a play-by-play announcer. An analyst is going to go, hey, man, look at that. Wow, he got open. He got the ball. He dribbled to the right side, saw a lane. Boom, look at that. Wow. That's kind of the job. I'm not trying to minimize it. It takes a lot of work and it takes a special skill. What I think happened here is this guy was going along and was like, wow, Kevin Porter Jr., man. And then probably in his head's like, man, I bet that's Kevin Porter's kid. And just went with it. Now, he would have gotten away with it, right? If Kevin Porter Jr.'s father wasn't in jail, didn't serve jail time for a manslaughter charge. Right?
Yep.
If Kevin Porter Jr.'s dad was just at home, sitting around, working wherever he was working, maybe retired, whatever it is, no infamy whatsoever, not a famous Kevin Porter at all, not involved in anything, he would have gotten away with this. Somebody would have said maybe afterwards, oh, man, like you said, like his dad. I don't think I want to let you know he's not Kevin Porter's kid.
Which we've had, I remember.
Sure.
At one point, we had two Steve Smiths in the league.
Right.
In the NFL. You know, you might have assumed that one might have been related to the other, but, you know, obviously no relation at all.
Oh, sure. And you just go,
not related.
He just chose the wrong thing to the wrong person.
But, like, to your point, if you're doing an NBA game, you're given a list of you got player bios and maybe but maybe it's not in the bio.
No, maybe it's not in the bio. Look, if I was Glenn Conser, if I was in his shoes, I would not speak on anything I don't know for sure. Right? I wouldn't just take a guess. Right? But at the same time, maybe he knows Kevin Porter, the player for Washington, the Kevin Porter senior. And maybe he knew that at some point he had a son named Kevin Porter Jr. This is just the wrong Kevin Porter Jr. Right? There's probably a lot of things going in his head. Here's the thing with LeBron. LeBron likes to speak out on this stuff, and I get it. But LeBron, I got to tell you, man, sometimes it's just a mistake. And it's okay.
I don't think it's on the same level as, say, Tom Brenneman.
No, I don't think it's not at all.
I mean, you can kind of make those comparisons because, it was said on air, although Tom, he didn't know he had a hot mic.
Right, right.
But I mean, I think it's along those same levels.
Here's the thing. What Tom Brenneman said on a hot mic, he said it off air because he knew he couldn't say it on the air.
Right.
Right? This guy said it on the air thinking he was making a comparison to a kid's dad that was a former NBA player that just happened to not be the right person. Right? And I think this is an innocent mistake. I don't think he knew Kevin Porter's dad. That's not going to be in the bio. Okay?
Right.
That's not going to be in the game notes. Kevin Porter Jr. has made it to the NBA despite his father's manslaughter. You won't find that.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't really tell you that much about LeBron James' parents.
Right. Exactly. I don't know what LeBron's family did.
Yeah.
I just know LeBron. I don't think your game prep is looking up what their parents did or did not do for a living or whether or not they were involved in criminal activity. I think it was just he took a hunch. He went with the hunch. It was wrong. But the way he said it, he just happened to be like the worst possible comparison could have happened. For LeBron to double down on it, saying, yeah, well, still, it's no excuse. You know what? It is an excuse. He made a mistake. It's okay, LeBron. It's okay. And in this type, I hope Kevin Porter takes the apology because I do think it's sincere.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network,
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, back to the Progressive guest line we go. Progressive making it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Jason Cole joining us, analyst and author, talking NFL. How are you, Jason?
It's great to wake up to some game in California by the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
No kidding, right?
I'm grooving to that. I like that. There we go.
I want to start with the AFC because if Derrick Henry plays for the Titans, they become, you know, they don't even need him necessarily to be the number one seed. But when we talk about who has the edge, who is the leading team, like the way we look at the Packers in the NFC, does Derrick Henry make the Titans that, or is it still a little bit more wide open?
Well, I think Dante Freeman's done a pretty good job of replacing him, hasn't he?
I think so too. Yeah, they run the ball pretty good.
Yeah, I mean they still know the power. I mean it's not quite the same, and you don't get quite the same kind of explosiveness and wearing down a defense. But I gotta say, Tennessee has done some pretty admirable things without Derrick Henry. You know, Julio Jones being banged up most of the year, which wasn't unexpected. But they're the most consistent team. They're the team I trust to show up week in and week out. Like, they've only had probably one or two games this season where you went, what happened there, right? So I like them from that perspective, but I still think that there's a limit to them. And if they get in any kind of game that's played in the, you know, like mid to high 20s, like, they've got problems with that, right? So, and Kansas City can do that to them. They can keep Kansas City under control better than most, but it's still where you can see Kansas City getting to 24, 28, something like that, and that's where Tennessee has a problem. But against anybody else, yeah, I like Tennessee against anybody else from a consistency standpoint.
And if we're looking at Kansas City, what is the thing that has sort of plagued them? Defensively, they've been better. They've seemed to be on a groove in that 8-game win streak. But yet, I don't feel the same level of domination fun that the Chiefs used to have.
Well, I mean, they've had to adjust. I mean, look, people play too deep against them all season, right? And Patrick Mahomes had to learn how to be patient. This was a very interesting season for him strategically in terms of learning to take the 6-yard pass and, you know, just get the ball out and not force things downfield. You know, he's had the most interceptions of his career this season because he's forced some things. And then, you know, he had the game that he played without Travis Kelce 2 weeks ago. And I think he's just had to moderate his game a little bit. And that's hard for quarterbacks because, you know, especially guys with that kind of talent. You know, you see Aaron Rodgers go through it every once in a while where it's like, okay, they're going to play me deep and they're going to take away anything downfield. I just have to, you know, take the short stuff until they start to come back up and play everything legitimately. It's been harder for even for Mahomes because he is so gifted. So that's been a really big part of their problem. The other one was, look, their running game was just atrocious early in the season. And they still, you know, didn't have quite the power in their game because they changed so much of their offensive line. It was tough. On top of the fact that their defense was just putrid early, got better, had this bad game against Cincinnati last week that makes you worry and makes you concerned. But I think ultimately they're still the team to beat in the AFC. They're the one that I can see being in the Super Bowl. And I will just say this one thing. I think mentally they're a better team having to play in the first round. They're not a team that's great playing from out. They're not a good front runner. They don't crush people the same way. And that's why, you know, bettors know this. They're terrible against the spread the last 2 years.
Right.
And not that I'm not a gambler, but I notice things like that because that means they're not playing to the level of expectation that everybody else has put on them. They're not they're not crushing people the way everybody expects. They don't have that kind of attitude.
When you look at that AFC, and you could see a Chiefs in the Super Bowl, you could see a Titans in the Super Bowl, you could even see a Buffalo in the Super Bowl. Can you see Cincinnati in the Super Bowl?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a – they're good. I mean, Joe Burrow is everything. He's the polar opposite of Baker Mayfield right now.
Right.
In that he throws to the right guy. You know, the game is not so complicated. I mean, it's not easy, right? But throw it to the right guy. You know, throw it to the guy who's open. Throw it to the guy who's got the one-on-one. And I think that people are going to learn really fast, like, never leave Ja'Marr Chase alone.
Right,
ever.
Exactly.
Right, like, just, you know, we'll take our chances with Boyd and Higgins, and, you know, we'll – but never, ever leave Ja'Marr Chase alone. Like, that's just – especially with – while he's playing with a quarterback who knows him so well from their time together in college, right? That was a – it was a perfect draft pick. I loved the draft pick then, and I love it even more now that I've seen those two work together at this level. But Ja'Marr Chase just makes the game so easy for people. I mean, look, you throw for 971 yards in back-to-back weeks, you are a dangerous quarterback, you're a dangerous team. Now, they ain't perfect. You know, I'm still not sure about their defense. You know, I think they're going to give up a lot of points, but they can be fun. They can be fun offensively. So, I could see that team because I just don't – like, nobody in the AFC overwhelms you. Nobody in the league overwhelms you. So why not with Cincinnati?
Yeah, and that's true. And one thing Ron and I have been saying for a while is that really this is one of the first times in 20-plus years that we haven't had an AFC dominating team. We dealt with the New England dynasty and then recently with Kansas City, and I feel like this might be the first time in a while that it's this wide open. Barring an upset, you could see any one of these teams go into the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, I just, like I said, Kansas City is the one team that can flex their muscle differently than the other teams.
Right.
That's what I see. And Tennessee can to an extent because defensively they're really good. But in this era, you know, this era is still about scoring, even in the postseason. So it's hard to be that good defensively unless some team is completely weakened in some way offensively that you can just take things away. So Kansas City's not that team. Kansas City will find a way to score on just about anybody. The question against a team like Tennessee is, are they able to get from, say, 20 points against Tennessee if Kansas City plays against them, can they get to the 24, the 28 that makes it harder for Tennessee? And likewise, can Cincinnati do that against those teams?
Over in the NFC, the Rams are all in. They got rid of all the picks, picked up star players, building this roster to win today. Does the Stafford situation concern you? He's been turning the ball over a lot.
Yeah. I mean, Stafford also. I mean,
Stafford should concern anyway, right?
Right. Like, I mean, what is there about Matt Stafford's career that says, yeah, we know this guy's going to show up in a big game?
Right.
When has it ever happened? And that's not to say he's not talented or that he's not a good quarterback, but, you know, like, I think there's, you know, playing in Detroit for a decade will do a lot of things to your head, okay? It just will. And one of those things is, like, as soon as something starts to go wrong, you expect that the house to cave in, right?
Good
you expect
point.
The roof to, right? You expect it to go bad, and then you press even more, and you add on to it. This is, you know, your one of your last chances to prove to the world that you're actually a good quarterback. Think about the pressure that's on Matt Stafford, based on what's happened to him earlier in his career. You know, he's been lionized, and not in the way that is good by the definition of the word, right? Yeah, I mean, I don't know how he's going to show up. I will say this. They have the most interesting player of the week coming back to play this week, and that's Cam Akers. Because Cam Akers is the closest thing they've had to Todd Gurley, right? You know, in terms of being a good pass catcher and an effective runner, a great combination, right? They've gotten through the season with Sonny Michel and Daryl Henderson. But Cam Akers is different. And Cam Akers showed last year that he can catch the ball and become explosive. He did that, you know, down the stretch last year. If they get that out of their running back position, they make the job so much easier for Stafford. Because they just, I mean, like, I think they've only, I counted it the other day, they've only thrown, it's 60-something passes to running backs this year.
Yeah.
I mean, they're living downfield. They have to make a living downfield because they just, those two guys, Michelle and Henderson, are not great receivers. I'm not saying Akers is a great receiver. He's not, but he's a better receiver than either one of those guys.
I want to get you out with this one. The NFC is going to go through Lambeau Field. Packers don't lose there very often, especially with Aaron Rodgers. But if there is an NFC team that you think is built to do that, is there an NFC team that is built to go there and could give Green Bay enough of a game to win at Lambeau this postseason?
Well, I mean, Tampa did last year, right?
Yep. But in a different circumstance. It wasn't Lambeau, right? It wasn't full and...
Yeah, but I was there when the Giants went in there, you know.
It can happen, there's no doubt.
Exactly it, right. I think Tampa, you know, you're talking about they've got the more guys in their 30s than any other team in the league. They're not guys that are going to be scared going in there. Certainly not the quarterback, right? So they can do it. The problem is, like, they're so beat up. I don't know that they've got it right now. You know, yeah. Godwin's hurt. You know, and the Antonio Brown thing is not just a sideshow, but, you know, he's talented. And now they don't have that. So they're going to have to get a lot of mileage out of the younger receivers who haven't necessarily played in that kind of weather and aren't battle tough in those situations and all those things that we talk about. So Tampa Bay is built to win in that environment. I don't know that they can this year. And anybody else, San Francisco can go up there and give them a game because they compound them. And the problem with San Francisco is, and we've seen it all along, is do you trust that the quarterback's going to make enough plays? And their whole game is based on reducing the number of plays required for the quarterback to be great. And that's when they're at their best. When they eliminate those number of plays that the quarterback has to be, you know, make great decisions or be incredibly accurate, they're better off. When the quarterback has to make a lot of plays, they're in trouble. But because of their running game, they can go into Lambeau and they can win.
Jason Cole, it was good talking to you, my friend. Enjoy the weekend, and we'll catch up with you soon. Thanks a lot.
Likewise. Be good. Thanks.
You got it, man. Appreciate it. Jason Cole on a Progressive Guest Line. Quote, buy, and save on home insurance with Progressive's new Home Quote Explorer, only at Progressive.com. I want to touch on something very interesting that he said about Matt Stafford when we come back. Wake up call.
This is Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, this hour of Wake Up Call presented by Rocket Mortgage. You need a mortgage that fits your life? Rocket can. So, Ron and I were just talking about why we like Jason Cole so much, because every now and then he'll just talk and talk, and then he'll bring up something and it makes me go, oh my gosh, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
And he did that with Matt Stafford in the analysis of Matt Stafford. And that Stafford, his whole pro career, he has spent in Detroit up until this season. And when you play for the Lions and play in the way the Lions have played with him for all that time, he has sort of developed habits playing there that sometimes gets him trouble on a team like the Rams, where he was in Detroit where he just never felt like his team was that good enough that he couldn't do more on the field, that he always had to do more all the time. Throw three touchdowns, probably need to throw four because we're not going to be able to hold the lead. Get a touchdown in the final 2 minutes. Well, I better be ready to go when my team gives up the long touchdown and I have to go back and try to win the game. Like he has probably been conditioned by so many different circumstances to always, always, always be pressing all the time, because the Lions can't hold leads very well, or he's got to go out and do everything he possibly can to keep them in game. He doesn't have to do that with this Rams team.
Yeah,
this is an entirely different team.
Think about it. Like, when he was with the Lions, I mean, he was like throwing 500 yards a game, felt like at times, because he had to.
Always throwing, always quickly throwing. I think you brought that up during the break when we were talking.
Yeah.
Just taking those steps back and firing. And as soon as I can get it to this guy, the better.
Yep.
And he doesn't have to do that.
And risking a bad pass.
Right, risking a bad pass. And he doesn't have to do that with his team. And he has a defense that, hey, it's okay. We can go three and out and not lose the game. Like, you don't have to, on third and six, you don't have to fire it so quickly to try to get first down. Let the play develop. And if it doesn't develop, it's okay.
And the Rams defense, if the Rams are up by two, you know, he's probably not used to a defense saying, that's 2 points. That's more than enough.
Right, right. And and that's a very good point that he made, because we're all human, right? These are not Madden video game characters. He can know off the field what he has with the Raiders. He absolutely can.
And he said
yeah, exactly. In the middle of the game, in the pressure moment, he has been dialed in and he has been programmed, if you will, to react to circumstances in certain ways based on what he has had in Detroit and the way he's reacted. And that could be getting him into some trouble. That is a fascinating look at that. Because again, let Cooper Kupp develop the route. Like, you don't have to throw it so fast. You don't have to get the pressure that may be coming. You've got a line that's protecting you.
You know, and you look at the flip side. You know, that's probably why, you know, Jared Goff has really been nothing in Detroit.
Right.
Because he hasn't had that mindset. He came from a place that Matt Stafford is. I mean, it's the most bizarre thing where you see two quarterbacks just kind of swap places. We never see this.
Yeah, I mean,
but the way Jared Goff plays as if, you know, there is another day, there is another minute, there's more time. There, you know, the defense will get the ball back.
If you play, like, look, no lead is ever safe in the NFL. We get it. That's kind of a cliche. But if you play on a team where that really is the case, like for years and years and years and years, you're going to bring that with you. And that's going to be hard to take out of your game. And your mindset is that every time you score, you better score again, because this one is going to get answered on the other end. And the Rams have a better team than what he's had. And that was very good analysis by Jason Coles. Way of looking at Stafford a little differently.